My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
Our next guest is the Orphan of Islam. Born into a Muslim community, aged 3, he was abducted and sent to northern Pakistan. On his return to England, he joined the British Army. Abused as a child, separated from his mother, a military veteran. Episode 10, Alexander Khan. This is Declassified. Alex, mate, it's really good to have you in here. And although the kind of your story will resonate with lots of people, I mean, for me, I can't get my head around, especially the first part of it. So we're going to crack straight in. You was born in 1975. Can you tell us a bit about your parents, where you were from?
Yeah, of course. I was born in 1975 in Scotland, Dundee. My mum's English. My father was from Pakistan. He had travelled to the UK in the late 60s and to work in a mill factory up in Lancashire. And he met my mother. They got together, and in them kind of days, it was kind of frowned upon for whites to mix with Asians. So what they decided to do was to move up to Dundee. They had friends there, so they moved up to Dundee, and then I was born. Things didn't really work out, so they moved back to Lancashire, and now this time they've moved back with a child, so that was even more frowned upon. You know, you've got this half-caste child.
Married?
They were married, yeah, so they got married out there. So the Asian side of the family wasn't happy at all. You know, what you're doing with this white girl, you know, why don't you just stay with your own kind of community? So there was a lot of pressure on both sides, and from my mum's side, her parents were like, you know, what are you doing, you know, mixing with this, you know, these people. You know, bearing in mind this was the late 60s. So with the pressure and I'm not sure what else kind of went on, when I was 3 years old, they separated. My mother had custody of me.
Why did they separate? Just to,
it just didn't work out. The pressures, the two different cultures.
Was your mum living in the kind of what like the Asian community? Was she like the culture of it all?
Yeah, she didn't kind of convert to Islam or nothing. You know, she wore the clothes just to keep him happy.
Yeah.
You know, she would learn how to cook the food and stuff, and he would always praise her for, you know, wow, you know, brilliant and stuff. But yeah, you know, with the food, the cooking side of things. So she wasn't in, and she wasn't kind of out. She was just confused, really. She was in her early 20s, you know, so she was a bit confused at the time. So then with all the pressure and the strains and the culture differences and the both backgrounds, they split, okay? And then my mother had custody. She had custody of me. My father wasn't happy with that. He moved back to his kind of community where his close family was in the UK, and he would come around and pick me up and come and see me, you know, a couple of times a week or a couple of times a month. This one weekend, I was 3 years old. Obviously, I don't remember this. You know, I was told this later on in life. He came to pick me up and take me out to the park. He picked me up, he put me in his car, and he drove me to Heathrow Airport.
It was just you?
My sister as well. Okay. I've got a sister as well who's okay. A year younger than me, so it was the two of us.
Yeah.
He took us both to Heathrow Airport, and we got on a plane, and we never saw our mother again, and that was the last time I saw my mother. The only, obviously being 3 years old, the only thing that I can remember is this pale face and this brown hair.
So there was no other memory of your mum?
Nothing at all. I was 3 years old. I don't remember anything at all, apart from throughout my life, just seeing this pale face and this brown hair.
And I mean, 3 is such a young age anyway, and there's so much more development to go on. And to be separated from your mum, I mean, I don't want to think about it too much, but
Where did you land? So you took off at Heathrow, and where did you go to?
Yeah, we landed at Islamabad, in the north of Pakistan, and then it's an hour and a half to 2 hours drive from the airport, Islamabad, towards Peshawar, towards the Afghan border.
Right.
So there's a village not too far from where actually Osama bin Laden got killed.
So, sorry, mate. So essentially, this is quite a big thing I'm about to say now, and you need to correct me if I'm wrong, and we'll edit it out if I am wrong. But your dad essentially abducted you.
Parental child abduction. My mother had custody, and he abducted me from my mother because he didn't want me to be brought up the Western way.
Right.
So he took me away. When they separated, she started seeing somebody else, and right. And he wasn't happy with that. It was a English guy she was seeing. But unbeknown to me, my father had already married. He was already married when he came to the UK. He was already married before he met my mother.
Your mum and your dad got married again in bigamy.
Yes, yeah. that's correct. Yeah, that's exactly what.
So where was the first wife?
She was back in Pakistan.
So she was back in Pakistan. Was he in the village then where you was kind of brought up?
Yeah, he stayed about for a bit and then he came back to England because of work.
Right.
And he would go back and forth, and me and my sister, we just left there to be brought up. My mother, she would go around to the Asian community in Lancashire. My mother Margaret would go around knocking the doors and trying to ask for her kids, and they would just brush her away. They'd feel embarrassed, this English woman coming around knocking on the doors. So they came up with this lie. So they basically said that, look, your children have died in Pakistan. They're involved in a car crash. They both died. Stop coming around. Stop knocking the door. Stop embarrassing the community. And then she started to believe that. You know, she started to believe that, and then she stopped coming around. But in the meantime, me and my sister were being brought up in Pakistan.
I mean, it must have been turmoil for your mum, and I know this is not her story, but to go through, I suppose, a grieving process as well, and certainly that separation must have been just horrendous for her. But 1982, you moved back to the UK, and you came back. Did you come back with your dad?
Yeah, it was me and my sister and my father. We came back to the UK.
Okay.
And we came back with my stepmother. So we all came back to the UK. We all went to this town in Lancashire. And then we lived as a family.
Did you call her mum?
I didn't at the beginning. I would see other kids playing about, and I would go, where's my mum? You know, and they'll say, oh, you know, don't worry about your mum and stuff, you know. This is your new mum.
Right.
So then eventually, as the years went by, we started to call her mum.
1985, you were 10.
Yes.
Your dad died. And then I want you to kind of take it from there, really.
So 10 years old, my father passed away. He had a heart attack. And then it was just my stepmum, me, my sister, and I had a couple of stepbrothers and stepsisters. So there was no man in the house. I was the oldest. I was 10 years old. So then my stepmother's brother, Rafiq, moved into the house. He took control of the house and he became the man of the house. And he would go out to work and bring in some money. And he was brutal. He was a bully. He would physically, psychologically, The day my father was buried, I was in my bedroom and I just woke up and I saw my father standing at the end of the bed, and I went downstairs screaming, and he dragged me back upstairs, and he just backhand across my face, and he punched me and he broke my nose, and that was the day my father was buried. So from then he was just brutal. He would lock me in an outside toilet for 5-6 hours at a time. And he will just mentally just torture you, physically, beatings. He would send me to Moscow all the time, a place I didn't really want to go to. I didn't know what was going on. So from my father passing away until the age of 13, 14, I was constantly in that kind of regime.
Why was he... did he have a vendetta against
your dad? Because obviously your story is like quite incredible, so just let me get this right. So did he have a vendetta against you because your dad had married your mum?
Yeah. I think it was partly that, and I think it was just him himself. He was just a bully, you know. He'd like to just... And he would shout out the other kids. But for me, for some reason, because I was slightly light-skinned, and in his words, you know, I had a devil mum, you know. He would put all these words into my head, and he would just... I think he got a pleasure out of it.
Was childhood like, was it a scary time then, just being in the house?
Absolutely. It was just constant. To get some time out, I would be sent to the mosque. And then you're reciting stuff that I didn't even know, you know. So that was kind of my time out of the house. And then I'd just walk really slowly back home, knowing that this bully was indoors.
Did you have friends as well?
You made friends at the mosque, and they kind of had their own kind of problems and stuff, and we would kind of I couldn't really talk to anybody. There was nobody that I could really talk to, so I just basically kept it in.
Did you have love for your stepmum? Was there love there for her? She's obviously brought you up since you were kind of young.
I'm not sure. I don't know if there was any love there. You know, she was nice, but then when the uncle, her brother, was about, she would kind of go really quiet and kind of close down slightly, and then he would kind of, you know, dish out his orders and just lock you up, really.
What was your schooling like? Was your at this point, you was in an English school. Was you thriving at school? Was you? Do you remember?
I didn't really go. We weren't really allowed to go. You know, this was you're going into the 80s and stuff. So there wasn't mid 80s. It wasn't around the time. You know, it wasn't as strict as it is now, where, you know, if kids don't go to school, they get
You was a teenager as well, weren't you?
So you know, and it's more concentrated on going to the mosque and stuff, and, you know, reading the Quran and, you know, being a good Muslim and all that kind of stuff. You know, what you're going to school for, you know, you'll end up eventually become a taxi driver or work in a takeaway. So there weren't education in my particular family and the community was like that. I'm sure other cultures within that kind of religion was probably different, but that's how it was. So I didn't really go to school or get educated at
all. But I think, you know, like, regardless of... Let's remove race, religion away from it. There's cultures throughout the UK in the 80s and the 90s and now that kids don't go to school, that there's abusive parents and step-parents and there's all sorts of kind of trauma that's going on. So, you know, if you remove that, actually take it down to the bare bones, there's a lot of this stuff happened and still happening right now. But this is where it kind of changes beyond... you know, normal comprehension, really. And that's that around 1988, you're 13, 14. Rafiq, you're not even your uncle, I'm not even going to allow him that term. Yeah. He sent you back to Pakistan. And once again, I just want you to kind of take it. I want you to tell me about what you were feeling, if you can remember, and what it was like going back to northern Pakistan.
Well, I turned 13 and my stepmother told me, you're going back to Pakistan. And my first reaction was, great, I'm getting out of this house. You know, so that was my first kind of reaction. But when I got there, you know, I'd obviously been brought up in the UK majority of my life until then. So going back... I really struggled, you know, getting off at the airport again, you know, just the heat hitting me. It was just so warm. Driving to the village, seeing people that, you know, I saw when I was like 6-7 years old and I didn't really remember them properly. So seeing all these different faces and strangers to me. And, you know, my stepmom said, look, you know, you're going on holiday.
Did it feel safe?
It did, because I wasn't aware of anything else. So it did kind of feel... Well, I'm, you know, just going to Pakistan, spend a couple of weeks out there, and I'd be back. And unbeknown to me, Uncle Rafiq, he had other plans. And what he had me done was he sent me, he had a brother and some friends in the village. So he got them to take me to a madrasa, it's an Islamic school. It was between Peshawar and the Afghan border. And it's an Islamic school where they send boys to learn the Quran, and it's like a boarding school.
Right.
Okay, so you're there. Once you're there, you're there. You have to stay there for a certain amount of years. You have to kind of practice the religion and read the Quran. And
is it just Islamic? So it's just to kind of indoctrinate?
There was no other subject. It was just whatever's in the Quran. And
did you know about these schools before you went? Had you heard about them?
Not at all, no. No, schools, like the schools in the UK, I thought there were schools there, but I didn't realise until I was dropped off there and I was left alone amongst, there was like 200-300 people there. There was kids aged from 4 or 5 up to, you know, adults 21, 22 years old. I would see, you know, guys with beards and so there was the age range was quite varied.
Was it a confusing time for you then? Because that's what it sounds like, the way you were even explaining. I can see your facial expressions trying to think about it. And you've relayed this several times, or many times. But was it confusing? Was it?
I think it was more scary and confused. I didn't know what was going on. I just couldn't believe what was happening. I was hoping to go back, you know, get back to Lancashire. And then I got taken to this place. So I was there for about 6-7 months, and it was just getting up in the morning, doing your prayers, you go to lessons, you read the Quran. Now, I couldn't read nothing. You know, I couldn't really speak English properly. Pashto, my father's language, I couldn't really speak that. And then reading the Quran, which is in Arabic, I couldn't read that. So I got the mickey take out of me from other students, the prefects, the teachers mocking me, because they were like, hang on, you know, you're a little Pakistani kid, you know.
Mm.
They didn't really realise I was of mixed race, but they didn't see that, so they just couldn't believe I couldn't really speak anything or say any of the words.
Yeah.
So, they'll hit you with sticks and stuff. On one occasion, they locked me in the room with an iron beam, and it was this was the 80s, and it could be classed as some sort of medieval device, but the idea was your ankles were locked in this device, wooden beam with iron kind of circles, rings, and you would stand in that. You couldn't sit down, you couldn't kneel down, and you would stand in an upright position, and you would read off the chalkboard in front of you. I couldn't read anything. I was just saying words that didn't even make sense. But I was put in there a number of times, and it was just like, it's just children who weren't picking up certain words, and they were probably misbehaving. They'd put them in this little
mate. 80s or not, that's not acceptable. Was young kids getting put in there as well, the little ones?
6, 7, 8 years old, you know, and it was an idea to get you in there, and you know, you have to read these chalk words and read over and over again until you can pronounce it right, and then the head teacher, imam, would come in, and then he would listen to you recite, and if you can recite it correctly, then they will release you.
What was like, because it's you know, you said there it was like a boarding school. It didn't sound like a boarding school. The where was you sleeping and stuff, like, where was that? What was the arrangements around all this kind
you
of?
Had sleeping chambers. You'd sleep on mats. There was no beds or nothing, so you'd have a mat on the floor. You'd roll up your clothes as a pillow, and you'd have a light blanket on you. So there was no beds. You know, electricity would go off, you know, a couple of times in the day, a couple of times of the night. You didn't have running water, so you had a well that you had to get water from. Cooking was all clay pots and stuff like that. So really basic stuff. Toilets was just as a lot of the fellow veterans have probably experienced out in Iraq and Afghan, you know, hole in the ground, and you do your business there. So it was just really, really basic stuff.
And was the, because I'm trying to get, because you see it on the telly, don't you? And I'm so far removed from that kind of thing. And you hear about violence and indoctrination and what you just said, like repeating something over and over again, regardless of religion, because other religions at different periods of time have done this kind of stuff. But was it like kind of ruling by an iron rod, is that the term? Yeah, ruling by an iron fist. Were they instilling fear into you to learn something?
Absolutely, yeah. That's the way they do it. And, you know, there's a lot of clips, you know, on YouTube of you know, children getting abused physically. And that's back in them, you know, that's in Pakistan. That still happens to this day. There's clips on YouTube, you know, on social media, of it happening in the UK. You know, kids getting slapped about and kicked and all that kind of stuff in mosques in the UK. So, you know, it happens, and it certainly happened back then. They don't. That's just the way they were brought up. They were brought up. They learned the Quran, the religion that way. So that's what they did. Certain kids will get to a certain age, and I wouldn't see them for a couple of days. And bearing in mind, in them days, you had the Afghan, the Russians were fighting the Mujahideen. So, you know, some of the students would go off and
the older ones.
The older ones will do a bit of fighting. You know, I didn't know none of this. I just, obviously, looking back at it now.
Yeah.
You know, they'd disappear for a couple of days, a week or so. Then they'd come back to rest. And
How far? Oh, right. So the students would go, come back for the weekend.
Yeah.
Have a bit of R&R and then disappear.
Just a couple of days, relax, bit of R&R, and then disappear again. And you know, but I didn't know any of that.
Yeah. Why would you?
That's
a kid,
right?
From
that's right, Lancashire.
Lancashire,
yeah. So what I knew I had to do, and I made a friend there, and we'd become quite close. I knew I had to get out of there. So with his help, he was much older than me. I was 13, turning on to 14. He was like 16, 17 years old. He was from Uzbekistan. We had huge problems with communication and stuff, because I could speak basic Pashto when he could understand and speak very basically. So with his help, I escaped from this madrasa, and I made my way back to the village, because I knew of certain points along the way. I knew from the madrasa, from the Islamic school, and my village, there was two key points, two areas that I knew quite well, or I've heard of. One was Peshawar, it's a huge city. And the other one is Karmara Air Force Base. It's a Pakistani Air Force Base. And the village was situated near that. So the chap who helped me, he just said, look, if you just get on a bus, just want to kind of cut it short a bit. But
I
got off. We found this low point in the wall. He helped me get over the wall. And I just ran. I ran through the desert.
Was the lad with you?
He wasn't, no. He couldn't risk it, yeah. He had his family, and, you know, his younger brother was coming to study and stuff. So he
needed to be there to look after him a bit.
Yeah, so he helped me to get over the wall. I didn't know what I was doing. I was 14 years old. And I think if I was much older, I probably would have been more aware of the dangers and stuff. But when I was that age...
It was all boys there?
Yes, it was.
Where's your sister?
She was back in the UK.
Oh, really? Yeah. So she never come across?
She never came. No, she stayed in the UK.
Was you worried about her?
I was too wrapped up in my own stuff.
Yeah,
I would often think about my mum, you know, what she was doing, and, you know, will she come and find me or get me out of here? So I was wrapped up in my own stuff. So it was just trying to get out of there and get back to the village.
You got back to the village?
I got back to the village, and I knew my grandma would help somehow to get me back to the UK. So I got back to the village and stuff, and they couldn't really believe what I'd kind of done. And some family members didn't understand, because, you know...
Was that, sorry mate, your grandma, was that your dad's mother?
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah, so yeah. This Rafiq that put you in there, that had nothing to do with them?
No, it was...
Okay,
yeah.
So you were back with your family, essentially.
That's correct, yeah. So when I got sent to Pakistan, I was living with my father's family. Yeah. And then, so I went back, and I, grandma, you know, she was just shocked and stuff, and they couldn't really understand why I escaped from somewhere where loads of kids want to go to. That's what they want to do. They want to go to a madrasa and become this scholar and all that kind of stuff. So we... grandma said, look, you know, I've spoken to them in England, and you're going to stay here. You know, you're not going back. You know, we've got no money to send you back. You stay where you are. So for another year or two, I stayed in Pakistan. I was just on my own, being brought up, playing by myself, and that.
So what was you then about? Because you eventually did come back to the UK when you was about, what, 15, 16,
I was, yeah, like I was going on to 15.
Why did you come back? How did you get back?
I was told I was going to stay there. You're not, you know, you're going to stay there. Certainly, my family in the UK are not going to send £500, £600, £700 to get, you know, to pay for the ticket. And they said, you know, you just got to stay here and just get on with life. You know, just shut up and get on with life. I had a favourite cousin in the UK who, when I was in the UK, you know, she'd give me sweets and chocolates and all that kind of stuff. She was much older than me. While everything was going on with me, she already married somebody from Pakistan. She was living in the UK. She wasn't happy with the marriage. She was going to leave him. Around this time, I was still in Pakistan. So they sent her back to Pakistan and she was murdered. She was murdered because she was going to leave her husband. And now...
I'll go back a bit, mate. She came out to Pakistan to your village.
She came to... Yeah, so she... They're all from the village. They're all from the same village. So her parents sent her back to the village because she was going to leave her husband in the UK.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So she was married to him. She wasn't happy. He was living in the UK.
Doesn't make sense, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the marriage wasn't working. She was going to leave him. So they shipped her off to Pakistan. Go to Pakistan, spend a couple of weeks there, get your head together.
Right.
Okay. Think about what you're doing. So she went to Pakistan, just like they sent me, go to Pakistan a couple of weeks, and then they killed her. So the husband, she came out, she stayed there for a couple of weeks, and I was glad to see her because I'd not seen anybody from the UK. I could speak
to. Was she happy to see you?
She had a really nice, bubbly personality. She was just really quiet. She didn't look right in herself. Yeah. But I didn't really know until after, when everything happened, then I started analysing things and seeing what she was like and why she was behaving in such a way. Because I didn't know. I was like, you know, why are you so quiet? You know, why are you not talking?
How do you know they killed her then?
He came, her husband came to Pakistan and after her, and he shot her. He murdered. It's called honour killing. A lot of it happens. So we were in the compound area. I was just, it was a rainy day. It was coming up to the coming into the monsoon season. There were rain everywhere. I was just playing in these puddles, and he walked in, and he had a gun, and he shot her. She fell on the floor.
Did you see it?
I saw that. So our body went into spasm. A lot of the women started crying, and he just left. Her husband just left the property. Okay. And because I saw that, within a week, I was on a plane and I was back in Lancashire. Because if the police come round and I would have opened my mouth, then it would have come out that I know who killed her. So they just shipped me off back to
the UK.
You must
have been shitting yourself.
Again, what I've been through and stuff, and I just shut down. I didn't know. I didn't talk to anybody. I got sent to this family member's house. And I got put in a room there. One of the family members stayed with me. I just didn't know what was going on and what. It was just a confusing.
And
I was absolutely shit scared.
But
all I know is within a week I was on a plane, and I was back in the UK.
Right.
You know, it happens. It happens to this day.
How old has she been then?
She would have been 23, 24 years old.
What was her name?
Her name was Aisha.
Fuck.
But later on in life, it would have affected me more than at that time.
Yeah, of course.
Because I was just all messed up and stuff.
Well, it's an appropriate time just to... I don't know if it is an appropriate time or not, but look, we'll move it. And you get back to the UK following that murder. And you move back in with the same guy that sent you back out to Pakistan.
I had nowhere else to go. I didn't know where my mum was. They sent me back to my stepmom's house, and he was there. They obviously weren't happy to see me. They knew exactly what I went through. And when I walked in, there was a lot of silence. But I noticed in him that he took a step back, because a lot had happened to me in Pakistan, and he knew that. So this kind of being aggressive and shouting kind of stopped.
Is that because you was more of a man when you came back?
Yeah, must have he said something. I must have stood up to him.
Yeah.
He would always send me to Moss to get me out of the house. And I said, I'll go when I'm ready. And he kind of, he thought, hang on, okay, there's something here.
Okay. You stood up to a bully, basically.
So he kind of backed off a bit. So then from the age of 15, 16 till 20, 21, I would just go to mosque, hanging about on streets. I had a few friends that I was hanging about with. We would go to mosques in Blackburn, Bolton, Bradford, and you know, we would listen to sermons, and we would go around streets knocking on doors and saying, you know, Asians' houses, and saying, you know, brothers, you need to come to the mosque and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of a brainwashing process, and I was stuck in this cycle. I won't mention his name, but one of my close friends at the time, he got stuck in this cycle, and he got sent to Pakistan by his parents, and then he got recruited jihadists there.
Like
I knew I don't know, there was something in me. I knew I didn't really want to follow that path. It kind of scared me, to be honest with you. I had no white friends, but I was a tadpole catching in a stream, and I befriended this guy. He was called John, and he lived in the same kind of area, but probably about 10-15 minutes away from where we kind of lived.
So it's about 1995, something like that.
That's correct. 94, 95.
If you'd be about 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So we became quite close and stuff, and I was fascinated because, you know, John, he's white. I'm half white.
Yeah.
You know, I was really intrigued about this other side of me. So we kind of kept in touch and became friends, and none of my family or
I really interrupted you then. I apologise.
Sorry?
Had you not ever integrated with anyone white?
The only people you would integrate with is when you go down to the job centre and, you know, you would...
On an official basis, and that is it?
No, that's it. You know, or you go down to the town centre and you see people about, and you might buy a pair of shoes, and you didn't mix. You know, this was, you know, there was a BNP about that time, National Front, and there was a lot of racism, and so we weren't really mixed. So I befriended this guy, we came quite close, and then he invited me to his house. So we went to this house, and I saw his father sitting there, his mum in the kitchen. So I kind of visioned this, you know, I could have been brought up like this. This could have been my parents. You know, she had brown hair, so, you know, I thought, this, you know, that's my mum, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was really quite interesting, because I wanted to see this other side of me.
Was it totally alien then? Like the house, the way it was kind of set up, the way people lived in, I don't know, in living rooms and all that kind of stuff. Was it totally different?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She was cooking something that smelled that I've never smelled before. Everything was kind of wide open. There was alcohol about and stuff. And, you know, there was stuff that I was told not to kind of... you know, we've been told from a young age not to do and not to say or not to touch. And I would see all this, and it was kind of, you know, intriguing, but, you know, scary and intriguing at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So then what... I don't know where to take it, because this is going to be like the fork in the road, really, isn't it? Meeting a kind of chance meeting with John, and then his brother came back, and what happened from there?
So, well... me and Paul, we were just in his room.
That's his brother.
So me and John was just playing in the room, video games or it was something. And then his brother walked in, Paul, and he was wearing black boots and camouflage bottoms, and he had a civvy top on. He just had a normal T-shirt on.
Mm.
And I was kind of taken back, and I was, you know, this... You know, you hear about things and about the military and... the army and but I knew he was some sort of military uniform, because I'd seen military soldiers in Pakistan and all that kind of stuff, so I knew he was some sort of uniform. So I was kind of really intrigued, you know, and I was a bit scared, because, you know, John said Paul's in the army, so that really fascinated me. So but up to this point, I needed an escapism. I needed to do something. I needed to kind of focus on something to achieve things in my life, because I didn't want to stay in the community and be a taxi driver or work in a takeaway, though them jobs are good and pay money, you know. I didn't want to do none of that.
It wasn't for you. It wasn't for me.
So yeah. I started talking to Paul, and he took me in his room, and there was like porn mags lying about and stuff, and I was like, wow, you know, I've never seen anything like that in my life. I was just really fascinated and chatting to him, and he told me about the, you know, the countries that he went to and the things that he did, and I just thought, right, this is what I'm going to do. Went back home, had a good think about it. A day later, came back. He was, I don't know if he came back on leave or he was stationed, I think he was stationed in Preston. I don't know what regiment it was, but he was stationed there. So then he helped me to get down to the Army Careers Office. Went down to the Army's Careers Office, pressed the buzzer, went in, he spoke to the sergeant. Sergeant gave me a couple of leaflets and said, you know, just sort yourself out, you know, get your hair cut. I had a ponytail, you know, get your hair cut. You do a bit of running, any physical exercise? I said, not really. The only physical stuff I've ever done was, you know, kicking a saggy football in the back streets, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing physical, you know, not playing football on a Sunday, nothing like that at all. And I was really interested, and none of the family or anybody knew that I was going to do this, and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Was you clever? Would you say you was intelligent?
Not at all.
But not academically, but did you have intelligence? Because it sounds like throughout your life you've had to deal with loads of stuff and come out of it. And you can't just toe the party line doing that kind of stuff.
I think I've been lucky. You know, if I didn't meet John, I probably wouldn't have joined the army. I wouldn't have met Paul. If I didn't witness the murder, I wouldn't have come back. So I think a lot of, I wouldn't say the murder was terrible, but it just, things happen.
For life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And throughout all this time, I always think about my mum. You know, where is she and what's she doing? And she's got a family now. She's got any kids? You know, I'm thinking more about her. And then I went up to Edinburgh, did my physical, medical, came back. The paperwork, rail warrants, all that came to John's house. Because it certainly weren't going to come to where I was living. Of course not.
Is that because the community would have kept you in?
Oh, yeah. What are you doing joining the army? Yeah. Why don't you just go to Afghanistan and, you know, fire some guns and stuff?
Oh, really?
Weapons. Right, so, you know, and one of my close friends, he did actually follow in that path. That's another story. Got all my stuff, got all my clothes in a suitcase, and headed south. And that was my road to joining the army.
And you literally left that community, everyone in it, packed bags, off you went, and then you went to Pairbright.
I only told my sister what I was doing, and I told her not to say anything.
Did you trust her? Did you trust your sister?
I did. It was just me and her, you know. So when I was in Pakistan, we kind of drifted apart because she was brought up in a certain way and stuff, so we drifted apart. But I told her what I was doing. Then eventually the family did find out. But by that time, I was...
on gone.
I was in basic training.
And how was that then? So, because for me, I pulled up, you know, wherever it was, Borkingham or whatever, and there was, you know, two buses of 16, 17-year-old white kids from similar backgrounds, you know, not experienced anything like you've done. And I'm sure... I'm going to speak for you here, like that's exactly what happened when you rocked up. And how did you settle in?
Well,
you're going to tell me there's a lot of Asian kids end up in the van in Fairbright.
I didn't really think of that. You know, being brought up in this community, I couldn't really speak English. Well, I still can't speak it correctly, but you know, I really struggled with communication and talking. I was really shy and quiet. So when I turned up at the train station, got off the train, there was a corporal, two corporals there, and I obviously went towards them. They took my name. They said, look, there's a vehicle in the back. Get your stuff in there. Jump in the minibus. And when I got in the minibus, all white faces, and I was like, shit, you know, I was just scared. I didn't know how to mix. You know, and I just sat in the back, really quiet, not knowing what was going to come ahead. There was guys talking about, you know, they'd obviously been in the cadets and stuff, and they were talking about stuff, and I was like, oh, I don't know what they're talking about and stuff, but I certainly didn't want to go back that way.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was. I just kind of just went ahead with it.
Leap of faith. Yeah.
Really struggled at basic training. I couldn't mix, couldn't communicate. You know, I wasn't that fit or anything. I struggled with fitness and everything. And then you know, a couple of months into it, I started to feel at ease, you know, and made a couple of friends, and I felt a bit confident. And you know, the PT sessions that we're doing, you know, I was coming at the beginning of the runs, and you know, doing good at swimming. So I started to feel confident
getting
in myself,
getting physically stronger, and
absolutely and physically, mentally, and I started to enjoy it, you know. And I went to speak to my troop commander, and I said to him, he said, you know, what's up with you? You're always quiet. You know, have you got any problems or anything? I just said, I don't think it's for me. He said, look, just give it a couple of weeks. Mm. You know, your training's going to continue. Give it a couple of weeks. Stick in there, and see how it goes. Mm. And that's what I did. So as the training progressed, and you know, I started to this broken child was kind of left behind, and I started to kind of come out of my shell to kind of.
Because you was a fully grown man in many ways, but because emotionally, I'm just surmising by what I'm hearing or kind of in my own head. You must have been quite far behind emotionally and again with the schooling and the communication. So this was you now really maturing as an adult, but you both, like you said, both physically and mentally in an environment where now you're kind of getting on top of it, and you're not going to get sent off to Pakistan.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get bullied. You know, there's a bit of banter and all the rest of it, but that's all part of that military community as well and military life. You then kind of decided... I'll kind of speed this up, but you then decided to do P Company and join a parachute support kind of
regiment.
Yeah. So who did you join?
Yeah, so when I was in basic training, you know, I started to feel good at myself and confident, and then I was speaking to one of the guys, and he said, look, you know, he said, what regiment are you joining? I said, I'm joining a regiment called 7RHA, it's an artillery regiment. He went, oh, okay. He goes, you know about P Company? And I'm like, no. You know, it's quite physical. You know, you got to be quite fit, and you got to do certain events, and you got, you know, obstacle courses and all this tabbing and running and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And I was like, I was just basically getting through, you know, struggling through basic training. But obviously, towards the end of basic training, I was pretty fit and stuff. So. And I was like, oh, shit, you know, okay, well, I'll have to do it. So from basic training, went to phase two training in Lark Hill, did the work on the guns that we do, and then I went to the regiment. And then when we got to the regiment, then we had to do this P Company. So then it was just a case of trying to get fit for that and passing P Company.
Yeah, I mean, go on.
Yeah, so it was... It was hard, and from my background, you know, John Smith, he's not captain, I've just made that name up.
Yeah,
but John Smith, you know, he plays football every Sunday, and he, you know, with his mates, you know, you do, you know, a lot of physical stuff. I didn't do any of that, you know, trying to get through that, and then, and I just kept pushing, and you know,
I mean, it goes to show, you know, that adversity when you come out of it, and then you do push, and you become quite bloody-minded about something you can achieve. So you completed P Company, you got posted to 7 RHA.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What did the RHA stand for?
7th Parachute Regiment, Royal Horse Artillery. Yeah. So it's just an artillery regiment that support the powers.
Yeah. Got you. So with the big guns and all the rest of it.
The 105mm light guns. So basically, so from phase two to the regiment, P Company, to the... regiment, doing P Company, then going off to Bry's and doing the jumps course, coming back to the regiment, and then going to Kenya and going to Canada. So you're just away with the regiment.
Did you love being part of the community?
Oh, yeah. You know, I really kind of fell at home, and you know, I was just a completely different person. You know, to this
really?
This chap coming off the train at Purbright, to this chap, you know, 2-3 years later, you know, the army completely changed. me, and he made me mentally stronger. So when, you know, going ahead slightly, when all the past catches up on me, you know, I was mentally stronger to deal with
you
it.
You did 7.5 years in, and you, like you said, you did things like Kenya and Canada, and you then got posted to just near Sennelager, so Bad Lippspringer in Germany on a, what do you call it, skydiving?
Yeah, it was a joint service parachute centre, so yeah. I was there as an assistant instructor, so we would do all the jobs that the instructors didn't want to do. But in the meantime, we were getting our jumps in and we were becoming a parachute display qualified. So then eventually, when I came back to the UK, you would jump into festivals, and it's just a huge recruitment for the army. But I met my wife there. You know, she was going through the divorce. She was married to a squaddie. She was going through the divorce, coming to the end. And she came and did a tandem skydive, and we started talking, and we got quite close. And then she was the only person I actually opened up to about everything, from what happened to me from the age of 3 all the way through. And it just felt...
Was it because that was the first trusted kind of female in your life?
Yeah,
think?
Of course. I didn't want to really speak to some of the guys in the army that I knew quite well, because if I really opened up, I didn't know how the reaction would be. So I kept everything in. Back in them days, early days, there was no internet or nothing, so I couldn't really seek any advice or help and all that kind of stuff. So speaking to Jessica, my wife, and you know. It all came out, and you know, it just felt great.
Was there major separation problems then with you? And I was focused on your mum then, because we haven't even mentioned your mum, and we're going to talk about her in a second. But was that an issue then that you was opening up to her about? Yeah, your mum and all that kind of issues going.
Yeah, because I had this story in my mind of what had happened to me and what I'd gone through. And then obviously my wife just telling me her, you know, what she thought. It really opened things up, and it kind of just got me thinking of Jesus Christ, you know, I have been through quite a bit. And it just felt great just speaking to her. And I wish I would have spoken to somebody earlier. I didn't really trust anybody and stuff, so... outside the military side, you know. Yeah. And I didn't really certainly want to speak to... in the military, because it's, you start talking about Pakistan, Afghanistan and madrasas to, you know... Bombardier, Jones, and you know, it just... Yeah. So I kept all that kind of quiet. So eventually, my wife, we came back... part of the time, we came back to the UK. She had early signs of cervical cancer, and then I decided to leave the army.
The one major event... And it kind of wilts in comparison to the stuff we've been talking about. Was you did go on Operation Telic, so we did cross the border from Kuwait to Iraq in 2003. And because I want to move on in a sec, but what was the feeling like around that? You know, because you've been, especially the early life, was really indoctrinated, and now we're going back to essentially a Muslim country.
Yeah. Once we got told we were being deployed to Kuwait, and then obviously we invaded into Iraq. I think it was just being on that border, and I'm sure you were there as well. On the border, you know, and I was just thinking, you know, on that side, the Muslims, you know, we were told from a young age not to kill Muslims and all that kind of stuff, and you know, our regiment, the first couple of days, you know, the amount of shells we fired was unbelievable, you know. Did a lot of damage and stuff. So, you know, I was thinking, you know, going to be killing Muslims. But I was there to do a job. I didn't really...
It's funny, though, isn't it, how that deep kind of penetration into your brain is still, it flares up.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's the Muslim thing. It's not even the person thing.
Yeah.
It's because you just indoctrinated from an early age. Don't do that.
No, absolutely. So, obviously, the invasion happened. We crossed into, I'm sure the guys listening would have done the same, went into peacekeeping phase. So we were, you know, then on the ground, foot patrol, vehicle patrols, and then we were sent back to the UK.
So you got back summer of 2003, left later on that year, and kind of did a bit of security work and other bits and pieces. 2007 came round,
yeah.
And you know, again, the kind of not the start, but really when Afghanistan was heating up, you was a civvy by this point,
yeah.
But then you, there was a big, was it a jihad? Would you, was that what it was called? Like, as in death threats against ex and current serving armed forces who were Muslim? Because that's what it was put in the press as, wasn't it? Like, people were targeted to be beheaded if you'd served in, and you were part of all that, wasn't you? You got wrapped up in it all, and people contacted you from the MOD, and there were certainly threats put against you.
Yeah, it certainly was. There was a group of extremists that wanted to go around and capture British Muslims that have served in the British Army,
yeah.
And behead him, you know. So it was jihadist, like act against war. So we were their enemy, yeah. And you know, we were the target. So I live in a different part of the country, and
yeah.
You know, I'm kind of really careful. You know, if I do venture up north or certain towns, I'm a bit careful and stuff, and because there is some crazy people out there.
So kind of after that, you released your book, which I'll put in the show notes, and I'll put on social media as well, and I'm looking forward to. I purposely kept away from it, but I'm gonna go back and read it. And then, and again, we could talk about this bit for an hour, but one thing led to another. Someone got in touch with you. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Someone got in touch with you, and essentially. You know what I'm going to say next? I think you should carry on.
Yeah, so when I left the forces and stuff, and my wife got better, so then I had this, you know, I had to find what happened to my mother. You know, I had to know. So, you know, I call it the final mission or something. But I had to find, so, you know, for a couple of months and a good year or so, I would go up to this particular town, up north and drive around and see if I can recognise certain areas and certain streets and I wanted to find my mother. You know, it took a good number of years with the help of my wife Jessica, and then we got in touch with this person that we friended, and she was a people tracker, and she came, she got as many details off me as possible, and she said she'll be in touch. 2 days later, I got a phone call saying, "I found your mum." You know, so I that just knocked me for six. I just, you know, I was, everything that had happened kind of really, really all came back, and you know, I felt like I was this 3 years old in her lap and just looking up at this pale face. So this person rang at my mum. My mum had done a bit of shopping, come home, the phone rang, she said, you know, your son, your first son is trying to contact you, do you want to see him? She said yes. So in that same night, we did a conference call over, you know, the person who was a tractor, got us talking, and then I heard a voice for the first time ever, you know, because I was young, I never couldn't remember anything. She started crying, I was crying, my wife Jessica was crying, just the emotions that took over. I'm a bubbly person and stuff, and I tried to break a bit of tension and just cracked a few jokes and stuff, and then we just eased and we just talked and talked, and then we arranged to meet. So it was Easter 2013 where my wife and myself got in a vehicle and we drove up north. Turned up at this town, it was slightly dark, rainy, knocked on the door, and I could hear these footsteps on the laminate flooring, and the door opens, and there's this woman with a pale face and brown hair that I remembered from so young.
The picture.
Sorry. And then she just started crying, and I was in tears, and my wife was in tears, and you know, I said, you know, she said, come in, and that, and we went in, and she goes, I said, I'm confused, I don't know what to call you, Mum or Margaret, and that, she goes, you know, I've always been your mum, you know, and come in and sat down, and then we spent the weekend just catching up on things, and then a lot of the stuff came to light that I obviously didn't know,
yeah.
About what happened to them and their marriage and him having another wife and all this stuff, and she didn't know about it, and we were told, she was told that we died in Pakistan. A lot of the things came to light. So after, 30-odd years, I've managed to find her.
Do you have any advice for any child or any adult survivor of kind of abuse growing up? Do you have any advice for them now?
There's all sorts of different abuses and people go through all sorts of stuff. But, if you have a family member or you trust anybody, you need to really speak. I didn't have anybody to speak to until I was like 28 years old when I spoke to when I met my partner, and I kept all that in. So a lot of it's affecting me now and certainly going forward. The army really made me strong-headed to deal with what I've kind of, because I'm much older now and I look at the past and I think, why and what I've been through. So if I weren't strong-headed and what I've been taught and done in the army, I probably would have really struggled with that. But it's just, there's always help, and there's stuff out there, people you can get in touch with, charities out there, there's a lot of support. And don't just sit in your bedroom and kind of just think that's it and I can't, I'm stuck, this, it's not going to get better. Look, you can make it better. You just need to go out there and seek advice and go for whatever you want to do, really.
Yeah, if the external factors are shit, you just got to keep real positive inside. Yes. There. That's what you can control. I wish we could speak for longer, mate. But, community is... It can define us and it can be there to support us as well as kind of break us down. And I'm really pleased that that military community was a springboard for you to essentially find love or get rid of that separation that was with your mum and finding, no matter what the trauma kids face and you certainly went through child abuse on almost a different level, you've come out of it and we've only just met, but I'm proud to know you, mate, and I'm really pleased that you came and spoke with us today. And thanks for coming, mate.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll leave it there.